Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Thank you.
Typical disgusting display.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
Typical disgusting display.
And it starts right now.
Oh, welcome back to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display, a podcast for writers, by writers, who hate writing, and we really do. Goldie, what happened? No cough this week? No first joke of the day with a cough?
No, I decided to just lay low and let the music play and see what happened.
Let the music play! So Goldie, we were just getting ready to start here, and I was looking for you. You're in the office, and I couldn't find you. Were you out voting?
Yeah, I voted, and you know, you open the ballot, and you're just confronted with all these positions you've never heard of, and you're like, yes. Assembly person. I like that person's name. They sound Jewish. Sure, why not? You know, like some state office.
First joke of the day.
So you're just, you know, going on just solely vibes, as my kids would say. I'm a vibe voter. I just look at it and I go, how do I feel about that? Reading about this proposition, totally cold, not knowing anything. I like bike lanes. Yes.
Yes, on bike lanes.
Leo Finkelman, you have my vote.
Yeah, but you know, then you get to the presidential election.
Sure.
And it just seems as though both parties are hell-bent on nominating the only person in the world who could lose to the other guy. It's insane. It's like anyone else would beat Trump besides Biden, and anyone but Trump would beat Biden. It's, what are we doing?
That's a great point. I've never thought of it that
way. It's a twilight zone of insanity.
I know. I got to say, I love Gavin Newsom. I don't know why he didn't step to the fore. Listen, I know people have problems with him, and polarizing. They say, oh, he did this, he did that. But every time that guy comes out, he's been on a bunch of talk shows recently. The way he supports Biden is exactly the way that you should support a candidate. He is full throttle, all for Biden.
I support Biden. I just think he is the one candidate in the world who could lose to Trump.
Right.
I'm purely pragmatic terms. I think Joe Biden has done an incredible job in an incredibly difficult situation.
Yeah.
But he might lose to the single worst candidate in all of
history. Yes.
Oh, that's very well said.
But not if I get to vote, not if my vote counts.
That's right. That's right. I wanted to tell a quick story about an experience up in Santa Barbara. We're living up in that area now, and our daughter Levy takes a karate class, and it's every, you know, Saturday morning, and so I end up taking her there because I think Tal's been on duty all week, and it's like, you do this, so that's totally fine, and it's very fun actually watching them do karate and everything. But there was this incident, I'll call it an incident, a few months ago, like right around Halloween, and a bunch of people I noticed were like lined up at the dojo door and all kind of just standing in the street. And it became clear that the dojo door was locked, but stuff was going on in the back. You know, the class was getting ready to start, so there's a lot of commotion in the back. But nobody was really up front and the door was locked. But there's a giant window looking out into the street. And so eventually this sort of like slightly older woman who was dressed, you know, for Halloween, because it was Halloween week and people with no personalities have to wear a costume all week. So she's dressed up as Santa Claus.
Oh,
okay. Mm-hmm. And she's an older woman who like gives off maybe at first glance like a hippie vibe, but probably would end up like in one of those videos where she's racially insulting like a Mexican fruit vendor.
Totally.
So she comes into the front and I'm like, oh, good, we're saved. So I like knock on the window and she looks out at us and I'm indicating, pointing at the door. She looks at us and she just throws her hands up and walks away.
Oh,
and
no.
And so, you know, now I'm totally pissed.
Yeah.
And so finally, you know, somebody did come out and open the door and I go in and that woman was there. I said, didn't you see us all? You know, we have kids in karate outfits. Like, right. We're not here to rob the place. Why don't you? She goes, not my problem. And then walked away. So now, of course, it's like a Larry David thing. Like every week I see her at karate yes, and I'm like, yes. There's that fucking bitch who would not open the door. And so sure enough, this week there are these little benches in the back of this dojo studio where you can watch your kids, you know, practice.
Yes.
And they're always, you know, crowded because there aren't very many of them. So I'm sitting on one of these benches and lo and behold, this woman who doesn't recognize me, like comes and sits right next to me on the bench. And then after a few minutes, she gets up and looks at me and says, will you save my seat?
Oh,
so she goes. And sure enough, you know, within two, which is already like, you don't like doing that in movie theaters when somebody right. asks you to
well,
say that.
Yeah, and also if you're 50, it's like, no.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. Exactly right. I hadn't even thought of that aspect of it, but you're 100% right. So sure enough, young parents come in and they come and sit down next to me and I say nothing. And I'm thinking about, you know, her fucking us as Santa, like, which is the most un-Santa-like thing to do.
I know, literally.
And so then she comes back and she's looking at me. She's like, didn't you, I asked you to save my seat. And I just threw up my hands. I didn't say not my problem, which would have been great.
Why didn't you say your catchphrase?
I forgot in the
you
moment.
Were thinking
See,
it.
You know, I'm only a retroactive comedy writer. I can't do it in real time. So, but it was great because she didn't get the seat back. She had to shuffle off out of the dojo. And I thought of this new thing. You know how people always used to say pay it forward? This is paying it backward. So I want to get this started where if somebody fucks you, you pay it backward and either fuck them or fuck somebody else.
I like it.
Is it
I like
stealing it.
It
backward is my only note.
Oh, instead of paying.
You're taking it. Taking
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think
did love the pettiness, of course.
Yeah.
I admire that.
I'm impressed.
I think just for the recognition's sake, you have to have paying it in there to get people
yeah.
to lock in. So maybe
yes.
paying it backward. So let us know, friends. Have you paid it backward? And what is your pay it backward story? And also, while I have Urea here, as Danny Smith would say, I want to let you all know that we here at A Typical Disgusting Display now have a YouTube channel.
Yes,
we do.
Yeah. And there's some, we put the Mulaney interview up there. I think maybe Seth Meyers. We've got Goldie's wedding rant. We've got a few things up there.
I'm posting them somewhat randomly, but I posted Josh Mankiewicz.
Oh, Mank. Yeah, he was our savior.
Yeah.
So check us out. It's A Typical Disgusting Display. That's the name of the YouTube channel. Please like and subscribe if you like
subscribe.
This podcast. And before we get into our Johnnies, which is hell, JC, I want to talk a little bit because I saw on Instagram this weekend they had that annual beefsteak dinner, which is like a big sort of Hollywood writer-y kind of event. Of course, I never go. Mm. But I saw pictures of you with some of our old guests, Vanessa Ramos and Gabe and people like that. So tell us a little bit, did you have fun?
I had a blast.
Yeah.
I saw so many people that I knew and met a lot of people that listened to our podcast.
Mm.
And including Samata, who listens.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to get her
on
Samata. The show.
That's not going to work, but we do love her.
She was hilarious. Met John Beckerman, who was really sweet, and you know, it's nice to meet a guest. We've had a couple of guests that I haven't met in person. I met Andrew Goldberg in person, which I'd never
met. Right. Yeah. No, there were a lot of people there. I always see the pictures. I'm always very glad that I did not go. but it was funny because I was hearing reports from other people about you being there and seeing pictures on other people's Instagram feeds of you there. And everybody was talking like, oh my God, JC, it was so great, it was JC.
So, it was pretty funny.
Duh, in a room full of dork writers, you come in looking like Jessica Rabbit.
Oh my God.
And suddenly, like, you're everyone's surprised why she's so popular. It's like, of course, this is our secret weapon,
oh
folks.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I'm glad you had a good night out.
Yeah.
Idea of getting together and watching writers eat is
with their hands.
One of the worst concepts.
No plates, no napkins.
I saw the Instagram of Chris Regan drinking scotch out of like a rib bone.
Oh
my God.
It was entertaining.
I honestly would have gone if I forgot we had the podcast. I would have gone.
I thought
people would be like, oh, I will listen to the podcast. It's like, oh yeah, I do a podcast.
It's literally a room full of our demographic. It was
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So literally preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
is what we're doing.
It was great.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right. Well, that sounds like it was a lot of fun, and something that is significantly less fun are Johnny jokes.
Whoa, from Hollywood, right near beautiful Houser Boulevard, here's Johnny.
Oh, yes. Some Johnny jokes, and maybe I think I'm even going to throw in a Norm today. I'm feeling Goldie-ish. Well, let's start with some straight down the middle Johnnies. France, country of France, became the first nation to enshrine a woman's right to have an abortion into their constitution. President Macron stated that it was an historic day for all those who like to...
Oh my God.
Getting very Johnny-ish. Okay. Maybe you heard about this. In a recent interview, Snoop Dogg said that he was once inhabited by a ghost. Ew. It sounds crazy, but there might be some truth to it, because later that day, he was arrested for possession. Possession. Like a ghost and weed.
Weed
did it.
All right. A lot of recent interviews recently. In another recent... Oh, no. This is a Norm. Sorry.
This is a Norm. In a recent interview, Mindy Kaling attributed her recent dramatic weight loss to walking and also lying.
All right. Last one. Monica Lewinsky. Yes, her name popped up back in the news. Monica Lewinsky is the face of a new upscale line of women's clothing. The company says the dresses are fashionable, affordable,
and scotch-guarded like you wouldn't believe.
I knew.
Of course.
You're going to get some jizz.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I applaud it.
It's all right. Johnny too. Johnny too.
Very nice.
Yeah, very nice.
Very nicely done, sir. Well, Buffalo is experiencing record heat this week. The temperature is high and wide right.
Ah, that's great. Excellent.
Mitch O'Connell is stepping aside from his role as Senate Minority Leader and said he's ready to move on to the next chapter. No word on what that is, but by 2028, he'll be old enough to run for president. A man in Qatar was sent to prison for logging onto Grindr.
Ooh.
Well, at least he found the other gay guys.
That's great. Excellent. Excellent.
Earlier this month, whales were photographed for the first time ever having gay sex.
Wow.
Mm, yeah. And if that's what the sperm whales are doing, you can only imagine what's going on with the octopus.
And don't forget about the humpbacks.
And finally, this is an Alex Sulkin. I'll do this. This really is an Alex Sulkin. Russia is sending convicted cannibals to the Ukraine front line. I'm not sure that's going to work out. Talk about a group that wouldn't mind tasting defeat.
Nope.
Oh, great batch, Goldie. Oh my God, that high was... and wide right. One of my favorites. Great. We should make sure all of our Buffalo friends listen to that one.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Friends, Frans, listeners, we are very excited today to be talking to one of our good friends. We can actually say that. Most of the people we have on here, it's like, eh. But this is actually a friend of ours. So today we are going to be talking to Chris Sheridan, writer, Woo! Producer. I first got to know Chris when he was running Family Guy when I was first there.
Wow.
And ran it along with David Goodman.
He did?
Yeah.
That's weird. He's like, no information.
Yeah, I'm just like reading this off a sheet. I'm as surprised as anyone.
Brand new information here.
But Chris,
did anyone fact check that?
We'll fact
first
check
time
that
to be revealed on this podcast.
Yes. It took 10 seconds.
I really wanted to get that first joke of the day.
Chris Sheridan was running Family Guy when I was first there. And did a fantastic job through the funniest, best years of Family Guy were when Chris was there. And he was there for many, many years and has now gone on to create and run a very popular sci-fi show that has now just moved over to Netflix. So I'm sure a lot more people will be watching it. Of course, that show is President Alien. And wow, what an idea for the alien to come down and be president of the United States. That's just a genius idea. And I love all those scenes in the Oval Office. You can tell I watch every week.
That seems a little off.
Oh, sorry. All right, I'm looking at the sheet here. Apparently, it's Resident Alien. Resident Alien, which is on the
side. And you run this with David Goodman?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, of course. It's got David's fingerprints all over that show.
I haven't caught it.
So that show airs on Sci-Fi. I believe it's in season 4 right now.
Season 3.
Season 3?
Yeah, I'm ahead of it. We're praying for season 4.
Well, I think you'll get it now, especially because, listen, look what Netflix did for Suits, which was just sort of a middling show that nobody remembered or cared about, and suddenly it's billions of minutes watched.
Sure. And so I know Resident Alien was very high on the Netflix charts when I last checked. So that's awesome. And Chris, you've already spoken several times, but welcome to the podcast.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm thrilled and terrified to be here.
I know. It's so funny. Let's talk about that for a minute, because I've been asking you for a while to come on and be a guest. And you were oddly kind of, despite the fact that you know all of us, and you probably know, 90% of the guests we have on the show.
It's true.
But what is it that you were afraid of coming on?
I mean, first of all, I'm a huge fan of the show, and I listen to the show, and every year on Spotify, it comes up at the end of the year, it tells me how much I've listened to the show.
Right, yes. Awesome.
And I love it. I did write you a letter at one point telling you how it's even from an emotional standpoint, it's, living in the middle of rural Connecticut, it's nice to have friends nearby, even if it's on a podcast.
Right.
Yeah,
but
nice.
I'm a fan of the show, and all of your guests are so good. I think am in this, I'm sure something from childhood, that I've done nothing and no one cares to hear me talk. So, and everyone feeling. I listen to, everyone you've had on, I'm just absolutely riveted. I was driving to Maine with Damien Fahey's, I was turning it up louder. I wanted to hear it more about the MTV shit. And I already knew that story. And I'm like, this is amazing. Matt Rice was amazing. I mean, everyone you had on has been fantastic. Great. I'm like, I'm not doing this.
It's so interesting to hear someone with hair has those feelings.
I did want to grow it out for this.
I know. He's got a great head of hair. I know this is an audio experience, but Chris shared an excellent head of hair. Now, it's funny, as Goldie and JC will tell you, the research that I do on every guest is,
extensive.
Astounding. Think of Woodward and Bernstein and the shot that pulls up over them in the library. That's me getting ready for this podcast. So, but I learned something today. I figured researching for today would be a snap because I know everything about Chris Sheridan, but I learned something today that I did not know. Ooh. And I'm praying that Wikipedia has this right. Okay. You were born in the Philippines?
Oh, I was, yes.
Yeah,
really?
Wow.
Oh.
Yes, how about that?
Started Why?
With JC.
Hey, it's us.
How did that come about? Yeah, JC, you guys can bond over
there. You go.
I've never even been.
Have a little Tagalog discussion.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. My father was in the Navy and was the aide to an admiral stationed in...
Subic Bay?
Subic. Okay. No. It was Sangley Point Naval Air Station, which I don't think is there anymore.
Okay, yeah.
And I was born in a city called Cavite.
Oh my God, that's where my family's from. That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Whoa, they're from Baco or Cavite. Do you know where Baco or...
I don't, but I'll ask my mom. I was only there for a couple of years.
Okay, so that's crazy.
So you were there that long. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So the admiral has AIDS and your dad is one of them. That's pretty cool. That's what you said, right?
That's exactly what I said.
Okay, yeah. That's what I said.
Yes, my father has AIDS.
So have you ever been back to the Philippines?
I have not, but my father told me, and it's probably was a lie, but that they never sort of declared my American citizenship somehow, but I have a passport. But he did say if I ever went to the Philippines, they could draft me into the Filipino army.
Wow.
So
I immediately was like, I thought that would be that. First of all, that might be a movie.
Right.
Some idiot college, rugby player on some drunken trip. Suddenly he's just standing in formation with these Filipinos.
He's towering over.
I happen to be watching Shogun right now, which is excellent. And that's your Shogun. You're going back to the Philippines, getting drafted into the army.
That's excellent.
Yeah. All right. So you, as many people have done in the past, you go from the Philippines to New Hampshire.
Yes.
Which
exactly.
is a common
a direct line.
Right. It's a feeder state from the Philippines. But
By the way, I'm going to add one thing about the Philippines. Yeah. Yeah. I did. You know how astrology is sort of based on, not just what day. Sorry, Tom. it's based on not just the date, but where you are born.
Yeah.
So theoretically, then someone who was born in your same place at the same time should be identical to you, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, similar. Like,
some energetically sort of energetic, yeah.
So I tried to look it up to find someone, anyone, is there anyone who was born in Cavite on the same day, or at least in like Philippines or something? And I forget his name, but you remember the lead singer of Journey?
Oh, Steve Perry?
Armand Pineda. Armand
yeah,
Pineda.
I think he was born in the Philippines the same day I was born or something.
What?
I don't know if he was in like the bassinet next to me or not, but I always have this thought that if I ever meet him, we're going to get along real well.
And you two, I would say, have kind of gone your separate ways, you know?
Oh, Journey. Good Journey drop. Separate
That's
ways.
It. That's it.
Let's change that. Arnell.
Pineda.
That's what it is. Yeah, that guy's an awesome voice.
You have the same birthday and everything?
That's
crazy. Thought I checked.
That's crazy. Yeah, I would have thought he was like much younger than we are, but
that's just the Filipino genes. You know?
Yeah, I guess so. JC, you can speak to that. So New Hampshire was basically where you grew up and had your childhood. Like that was your, that was your growing up. So a lot of fireworks,
a lot of fireworks,
a lot of liquor stores,
a lot of Lake Winnipesaukee and Weirs Beach and
Camaros and
a lot of Camaros.
How are you not an asshole?
Oh, that's so nice.
I'm just a little farm boy from New Hampshire. I was on the other side of the tracks.
Okay.
No, it was a great place to grow up. I mean, there was nothing going on, but you sort of, back then we created our own.
Yeah. Every weekend was like a Mountain Dew commercial. You're rope swinging into a quarry.
was a lot of that. We're skiing up at Gunstock. That's the mountain up there. But it was great.
And what part of New Hampshire?
I was from a town called Guilford, which is near Winnipesaukee.
Okay.
Didn't we have a guest that lived?
Yeah, we've noticed that there's like a comedy cluster in New Hampshire, right? Yeah.
So there are some people up there.
There's Adam Sandler, Sarah Silverman, and who is it? Seth Meyers?
Michael O'Malley, I think, is from New Hampshire as well.
Wait, one of our guests recently, sorry, I can't remember, but told us that he moved.
Dimitri Pompei.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
That's right. Good pull.
From New Hampshire. Nice.
Yeah.
For real.
The Hamp. So you grow up there, and I was reading that you were very interested in writing from a young age, but you kind of felt like it wasn't a realistic outlet for you. Like you didn't see like, okay, that's going to be my career, but you liked it.
Yeah, I did in high school. I did journalism and, wrote for the paper and stuff like that. I didn't even know this was the 70s and 80s. I didn't know TV writing existed or film writing or anything.
Yeah.
So I had no idea that that was a writing thing that people did. So I did the journalism stuff and I didn't really know. I went to college. I was thinking about being a math major, actually. I didn't really, I had no plan.
Math major.
The opposite of funny.
and then like junior year in college, I overheard in an English class, some girl said that she wrote a screenplay. And that was the first time I even heard that someone wrote something like that. And then it clicked. I was like, oh, that's exactly what I want to do.
Right. Sorry.
So someone in passing was like, I wrote a screenplay.
That was it.
And in your mind, you said, okay, a screenplay, that must be a movie. Yeah. I want to do that now.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Like I knew that movies were written, but I had never thought that was for someone else to do. Like,
right. I still feel
now.
That way. Yeah.
it's different now because we have the internet and we can watch table reads and stuff like that.
I know.
But I grew up in New Hampshire. Like there's nothing, there was no one's talking about writing movies or writing TV. And
no,
I had no, and that's all I did growing up. I watched TV but I'd never, maybe it was just the fact that I heard someone else did it somehow gave me permission to be like, okay, that could be my path as well. But that's when I knew immediately.
Yeah. Now, talking about growing up and comedy and watching TV and all that, like what were the kinds of things like that you remember from your childhood that made you laugh when you were growing up? Like, what kind of stuff did you watch?
Yeah, like old Steve Martin albums. Loved. Eddie Murphy. Raw was everything. I remember being in college and getting this cassette tape passed around that had the Jerky Boys written on the front of it. And these guys are funny,
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that. But growing up, all the Norman Lear shows, loved MASH.
Awesome.
Happy Days was huge.
Yeah.
Really loved Cheers. I mean, the turning point for me to finally go to LA was off of, it was a Cheers moment. I used to love Cheers so much that I would literally have to watch it standing up. I was so excited be watching Cheers.
Really endearing.
Like a Super Bowl.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember I was 24. At this point, I knew I wanted to be I had figured out the screenplay thing and like, okay, I could write films and maybe even TV because I like TV. But I'm at this point, I had gotten back from college. I was living at my parents' house in Guilford, New Hampshire. I was bartending.
Right.
And I was making, you know, $110 a night in cash from that. That's so good. I'm like, I'm rich, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I got plenty of time. I'm 24. I mean, writers, they got to be like in their 50s, right? So I'm like, I got plenty of time. But I remember watching this thing on TV 38. Dana Hershey was doing this thing at the Bull and Finch, which is the Cheers bar in Boston. And it was like their 200th episode or something like that. And they were having a party there. And I remember, you know, interviewing like George Wendt is like shit faced and, you know, they're all like having fun and partying. And then Dana Hershey cuts to, you know, who says the two showrunners of the show, the two bosses of the show.
Yeah.
And maybe Dan O'Shannon and Tom Anderson, who at the time were probably 26, but looked about 18.
Right.
And I'm like, wait, those are the bosses? I got to get the fuck out of here.
And so, is that really what brought you out to LA? Like,
100%. Yeah. I mean, I knew someday I would go, but I was like, I got time.
Yeah.
That's when I realized I didn't have time. So the next day I said, I'm done.
It's funny.
What's the plan when you do that? You just go, I'm going to show up there. Do you have anything written or did you just think you'd figure that out later?
I was in the process of writing stuff, but hadn't finished anything yet. I did have one contact through my uncle knew someone from growing up who was a TV writer on a show called Perfect Strangers.
Oh, I think we know who this is.
Yes. The one and only Tom Devaney.
Oh, there he is.
So I wrote a Mr. Devaney a letter. Dear Mr. Devaney. And he makes fun of me for this all the time. You're friends with my Uncle Tommy and I'm interested in coming to LA and maybe we can get together for lunch. So
that's really sweet.
I went out there and
knowing Tom now, that's even funnier. It's just going out to the mailbox and what do I get? A letter from Tommy's friend.
And you did. You met up with him.
Yeah, right? I did. I packed up my car that May and had a plan to move. And then on the day I was leaving, the LA riots started.
No.
I was like, maybe I'll put it off a week, see what happens.
Maybe I don't want to get brained at an intersection.
Just packing my luggage at home, looking up at the TV, like, what's happening here? Where's that?
Did you just tie yourself to your car seat so they couldn't drag you out?
Yeah, literally just zipping up your duffel bag and like, maybe I'll unpack for a little while here. Let's not rush it.
I did a week. So then a week later I left and I remember my dad, as I was leaving, he was like, hang on, I got something for you. And I assumed he was going to give me money. You know,
yeah,
like
sure.
Barely anything. He comes out and hands me a tire iron. he says it's not for the tires.
Oh my god, that's such a great what a New England moment that is.
So
did you drive out, and if so, what car?
I had a 1987 Honda CRX hatchback.
Yes. Nice.
Yes, it's a sports car. Thank you.
Oh, sure.
Big time.
Were you biting, white knuckling it through Colorado? Like, come on, just make it over the hill.
It's on snow in Wyoming. I did. I went with my sister and there wasn't a lot of things I wanted to see along the way, but there was one stop in Dyersville, Iowa. And you guess
was your sister going to be a writer too?
No, she just was going for the ride. No, she just wanted to go for the ride.
Is she going
to
fly back or
stay?
Yeah,
fly back. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she's going to. She drove me.
All right. So Dyersville, Iowa.
Yes.
What we're going to guess what site
you don't have to. I'm not going to.
No, I want to. That's okay.
It's a site that there was a movie that had come out a couple years earlier that I wanted to sort of
Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams, 100%.
Bingo. Oh, nice.
Great guess.
Well done.
way to go. I hated that movie, but I'm glad you had that moment yourself.
Why?
So I loved it. That movie, I watched it again.
It's a Republican fever dream of America.
Oh my God.
I've never heard this take.
I didn't know that.
It is. So it's like the Reagan era of America on screen, writ large.
Wow.
Now I hate it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because people love Bull Durham too. I can't stand that. That's a a chick flick in disguise, is Bull Durham. But okay, so you come out to LA and you meet with your great mentor, Tom Devine, yes, our friend. And so how soon after getting out to LA did you land your first job?
Probably 5 months, I think. When I first got out there. So this woman, I ended up being friends with this woman who I heard, I wrote a screenplay. I got to be friends with her and worked with her a little bit. And then she was in LA living with her husband and daughter in Brentwood in a one bedroom apartment. So when I moved out, I stayed with her and slept on their couch for like 3 months.
Wow.
And that's where I was
in a one bedroom.
It was awful.
And she's like, the guy who overheard me make a comment about a screenplay is now living with my baby.
I ended up. So the other part of that is that in college, got to be friends with her. And then she started a magazine called Interrace Magazine about interracial relationships because her husband is white and she was black. And I ended up for a year after college working with her on that and helping her with that magazine.
Oh, that's
cool. Living in Schenectady, making no money and eating mayonnaise sandwiches.
No one knows more about interracial relationships than this New Hampshire bartender.
You know, I saw a black person once. Yeah.
You gotta start somewhere.
And so what was that first job?
The first TV job?
Yeah.
Was a, got to know Tom. Tom handed my resume along to the Keyes brothers, who were his cousins. And my first job was a PA on a show called Shaky Ground, 1992.
Wow.
That was a Matt Frewer show on Fox. So the PA for about 4 months. And then the writer's assistant, one of the two writer's assistants left. And I sort of talked my way into becoming a writer's assistant because I could type really fast. So then I became a writer's assistant. And that was my first job.
That was
fantastic.
It.
But,
amazing.
You know, but it's like that first year you're out there, I worked till 4 a.m. every night. That's... You know, a lot of nights like just driving home and morning traffic, but loved every second of it.
Yeah, that's an important detail, though, because I feel like the generation now may not understand that the role of a PA has always been that dedication. Like you just said, sometimes you're working till 4 a.m, but you loved it. I think a big difference in what's going on now where,
it wasn't a lot of the job then just dealing with the paper media of scripts because there was computer.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, there were computers, but not.
And I'll tell you the reason that, so Deb Oppenheimer was the woman's name who hired me. And the way I got hired, she was the producer, was I remember in the meeting with her and she asked me like, what's your deal? And I was like, I should lie and just tell her I live out here or something. Cause I was, I had driven out a few months earlier and I was living on someone's couch, but I was like, I'll just tell her what the deal is. So I said, I just packed my car up from New Hampshire and I drove out and now I'm sleeping on someone's couch. Basically.
Yeah, right.
And that's what got me the job.
Did he say
she's
the couch
thinking,
of an interracial couple? There's a whole magazine. You should read about them.
And then I think she's thinking like, if this person's willing to drive all the way out here and sleep on someone's couch,
yes,
they're dedicated to this and they're going to be a good PA. So
that's true. And were you a good PA? Do you think you were a good PA? That's awesome.
I bet you were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went overboard in every single way. So,
that's awesome.
You know, same as a writer's assistant. We were supposed to be there at 9. I'd come in at 8 every day and take scripts off the shelf and just retype them in to the computer program to get better at the computer program.
Oh, wow. My God.
So, but it paid off.
I hope young people are listening to that.
I know.
Because
I mean, it's the way it used to be.
I know.
Yeah.
We have, you know, it's the way it is today. It just feels like people come in and they sort of in week one, they're asking you to read their scripts. And it's can you just please have a little bit of a track record here before you leap into this
part of it.
Yes.
That was something I learned early on, which is if you do the job that you were hired for really, really well, eventually they'll ask you to read your scripts and then they really care as opposed to just shoving it to them early.
Can I just add something? That's a great lesson. Everyone under 50 is a moron.
Yeah. We just made it.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, you're all stupid.
That's a good bullet point there.
Has nothing to do with the fact that I'm 51.
Yeah. You made it over the hump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're a PA and then a writer's assistant on this job. Yep. And then what you roll into another job, which was
that show was canceled.
Yeah.
Then I'm looking for a job and I get a call from, I haven't brought him up yet, but a guy named Tom Devaney worked his way over to a job on a show called Thea, which was a Castle Rock show for ABC.
Yep.
And they were looking for a writer's assistant. So then I got a job over there and I worked there for a year. And then that year I was able to write, to do two things. One, write a freelance for the show that never got produced because we got canceled again. But also was able to get an agent for that reason that I said, which is I didn't ask anyone to read anything. I just did my job. And then the executive producer, Andrew Susskind, came up to me at one point and said, "You're doing a really great job. Do you want to be a writer? What is your path?" And I said, "I want to be a writer." And he said, "Do you have a sample?" And I showed him my sample and he passed it along and I got my first agent that way. So
this is going to sound like a joke. It's not a joke. Did you get that job at Thea? Did it come up that you had written for an interracial relationship magazine? And did that help?
Yeah, it did not.
Okay.
No, because I was a writer.
Curious thing in your resume that like you kind of go, help. Oh, would someone go?
Yeah.
Whoa, yeah, and you could write for Thea, of course, because you've put a toe in these waters. But
it might have mattered, but I mean that was a job as a script coordinator, so it wasn't really relevant. But if I was going up for writer, it might have helped.
Yeah.
I mean,
so you get an agent through working at Thea, and you write a freelance that doesn't get made. So where were you when your first script actually did get made, and it made it to television?
Living single. So yes. From Thea, said after Thea was canceled, I was cleaning up the office and I got a call from a woman named Yvette Lee Bowser, who was looking for one of the other writer assistants, because I guess there was some talk about them coming over to be a writer assistant. And that person had already left for the day.
Right.
And I said, "I'm sorry, that person is gone. What do you, can I pass along a message?" And she says, "Well, yeah, we were going to talk. I need a writer assistant over here." I'm sorry, what? I'm sorry. Oh, I think that other person's working now. I don't think they're available. But anyway, so I went over and met a vet and I got a job over there. And
awesome.
And then I got, she gave me a freelance the first year I was a writer there. And then, first year I was a writer's assistant, she gave me a freelance. And then
it's amazing.
Hired me back as a writer's assistant again and gave me another freelance. And then the third year I was there, made me a writer.
I love
That's
it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You That's worked awesome.
And
to
I,
get
and
there.
I bet. Whatever episodes you wrote for that show were your most watched episodes of anything because just people used to watch more TV then.
They used to.
Like, 20 million people watched my episode last night.
That's, it's so funny. I hadn't thought of that. But
I do wonder if the decline of phone conversations has like really decreased the opportunities like that to, take a phone call and then turn it into something else.
Ah. Right. Like intercepting that phone call.
It is true. That is true. Because if she had texted that person on her call on her cell phone.
Or emailed.
Because this was well before, well before cell phones. So
yeah.
It was all landline shit.
By the way, a little detail, that other person whose opportunity you yoinked, David Goodman.
Yeah.
It all ties
together. It all comes around.
He's listening somewhere going, "What? Oh, no, wasn't. I wasn't even there."
So then I was on Living Single for 2 years. And then in the after being a writer for a year and a half on that, it was canceled in like January of that year. Okay. I was out of work for 6 months, wrote another spec script, taking meetings.
Right.
And then I've told this story before, but I thought I was going to be on a show called Veronica's Closet because I had a bunch of meetings over at Bright Kaufman Crane. They had Friends. They had Jesse, I think. They were the new sort of juggernaut of the new Miller Boyette. They had all these shows and Friends.
And it had your
Kirstie
Alley from Cheers. So you must have been like pumped.
I mean, this is going to be fantastic. And I met over there a bunch of times and they said, "Okay, we think we're going to put him on Veronica's Closet." And my agent was like, "Okay, he's taken care of. Let's deal with someone else." And then this is, April. I didn't get another meeting And then in June, and back in the day, like June is when all the shows started. So yep. It's first week of June. I'm not sure when I'm starting on Veronica's Closet. And I get a call from a friend of mine who's a writer's assistant. And she called me and she said, didn't you say you were going to work on Veronica's Closet? And I said, yeah. She said, well, I'm a writer's assistant here and they've been working for a week.
Oh, like, God, wait, that's what? The worst.
What happened?
What are you talking? So I called my agent and I told him the story and he was like, I'll call you back.
Oh, God.
So he calls back 5 minutes later. Okay, so it's not going to work out at Veronica's Closet.
Oh, no.
That's so perfectly agent story.
They had to hire this writer, Amy Sherman, who I guess was very expensive. And they didn't have money left for you.
Hats off to Amy Sherman.
I was like, he said, but there is one show left hiring. This is middle of June at this point. And at this point, everything's done at this point.
Yeah.
One show left hiring, and one of our clients is going to help run it. It's a cartoon. And I'm like, oh, fucking cartoon. I'm never working. This is like absolute career is over. I drove all the way out here. No, oh it's God. Good. It's called Family Guy. It's like The Simpsons. Never watched The Simpsons. Don't care.
Oh, God.
It's from this young, upstart 24-year-old kid from Rhode Island School of Design. He's like, I could care less about this. And they're like, just go in for the meeting. I'm like, yeah, okay, fine.
It's so funny you mentioned, like, because around that time, I think. You might be like 1 or 2 years older than I am, but we're around the same age, like
56.
Oh, okay. Way older than me. I remember I was on a plane and I was going out for a job in San Francisco, not LA. Like I still hadn't admitted to myself I wanted to do this. And I was reading Newsweek and there was a story about, it must've been about Seth. It was about this Family Guy thing, which I was unfamiliar with. Cause like you, I didn't really watch The Simpsons, didn't care. Wasn't where a Family Guy, but I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I hadn't admitted it to myself. And I saw this thing about Seth and I was just like, fuck this guy on the plane. I was reading it, thinking to myself, fuck him.
Fuck him and his kitchen table.
Yeah, I think it was about his principal being mad, like not being allowed back to his high school or something. And it was a Newsweek, which, I had. Very important how I used to stay up on the news.
Well, so you go in for a meeting. Was it with Seth?
Yeah, it was with Seth and David Zuckerman. And I went in and honestly, I think I got the meeting because I didn't really want to be there. It's like that. I was so disappointed because I could have been on Veronica's Closet and now I'm stuck on Family. Like, well, my career has taken a turn. And I was so upset. I was just like, okay, fine, whatever. I'll meet with him. It's sort of like Morgan Freeman in Shawshank, like when he finally says, I don't give a shit if you let me out or not.
I don't give a shit. Yeah.
Yeah. It was sort of like that. You just totally relaxed, But I did in that meeting immediately, like I did bond with Seth. Seth is from New England and I got you watched the 3-minute presentation, whatever. And I did get what it was. And I think in that meeting, I talked about Peter and I was like, I know who that guy is. Like that is every fucking New England idiot, that I know from growing up.
Yep.
So we bonded over that. And then I got the job and, we started, as I'm sure you've heard, in the King of the Hill offices, the first day we worked. And from that first, first we worked till 4 a.m. the first night.
Oh.
But from that first day, I loved every second of it. Loved all the people and I loved the show. And,
well, I'm happy to say that we still work till 4.
Yeah, PM.
It might be a different 4, but
the other piece of that was that Veronica's Closet lasted one more year than was canceled. And Family Guy's been on the air since.
Still,
25 years later.
Not only that, Kirstie Alley's dead.
Oh, you picked right. You chose the right door.
I chose the show that was going to outlive Kirstie Alley alone.
They can't revive it. But they want it.
And it was a good lesson, actually, that you just never know. You just never know. You're always... Yeah. A lot of times you're in the situation where you get to pick A or B, like this show. Well, this is the hot show, but I really like this show over here. I'm going to pick the hot show that's a guarantee. And then that show never goes anywhere,
Right.
And the one that you liked actually ends up being successful. That was a turning point for me where from that point on, I told myself, I just am going to make decisions based on what creatively I think is more interesting or more fun. And then the business part of it will just fall the way it's going to fall.
And that's,
yeah, well, that's for wise you. Advice.
How long did it take for you to kind of internalize that you weren't going to have to go back to being a PA or a writer's assistant?
About 3 minutes into the first job as a writer. Actually, it was the end of the first day as a writer when the day was over and I could go home and not stay later and do all the other stuff that writers are supposed to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I almost felt bad. I'm like, bye. You know, I know what you're going to do for the next 7 hours. And the PAs, because back then, you're right about the paper stuff. Like the PAs back then had to wait for the script to be done, go to the copy machine, make 400 physical copies of this script, get in their car, drive around town, dropping on actors and executives' steps.
Yep. Oh,
wow.
And often at like 4 or 5 in the morning.
Yep.
Like stepping over, like fighting dogs, walking through the rain, dropping the script at 4 a.m. on an actor's doorstep on top of the 3 other scripts that they've dropped every night for that week.
Right.
Only to come in the next day and have the actor constantly say, I never got a script last night. So I don't know what to say.
Actors are the worst.
And then not having to do any of that anymore. And yeah, it was.
That's great.
It
was so much of life in my 20s. I remember just having to fix a Xerox machine, you know, like having to be intimately familiar with all the ports and ways you could open a Xerox machine.
Yeah,
there are like 7 doors.
So many.
Yeah.
I always love that little piece of that industry that requires the guys that come to fix it that are going to get ink all over them have to be in like a white button down shirt and a tie somehow. Why is that the outfit?
Right. just wear like a black jumpsuit.
It's so weird. Just make a suit out of ink.
Yeah, I remember I did the exact same thing when I went at SNL as writer's assistant on Saturday morning. I used to have to go around Manhattan and deliver the final scripts to Lorne, you know, Mike Shoemaker, the other producers, leave them on their doorstep. And I remember it was so insanely early, you know, it'd be between like 6 and 7 in the morning, but then it was a show day. So I would come back to the SNL offices. I remember this vividly. Smoke pot in Tim Meadows' office, lie on his couch and listen to Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill until people came into the office. Oh, that was like my morning ritual.
The best.
Okay. So Family Guy, and we all know the history of Family Guy, canceled a couple of times, then brought back in 2003, 2004. So how did you learn that you were going to be running the show when it came back? Like what was that? How did those conversations go down?
Well, I was on Yes Dear at the time with Danny Smith and Greg, Yes Dear run by Greg Garcia and Alan Kirshenbaum, rest in peace.
Right.
But Greg Garcia had worked on at some point for a while in the second season of Family Guy. So I knew him from there.
Right.
So Danny and I were working with Greg. And I just got a call, and I knew there was some talk, someone saying, I think Neil Goldman, who's a writer, had called me and said, you know, I'm hearing that the show may come back. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's been off for 3 years. I can't come back.
Yeah, and then
I'd heard some buzz about that, which I sort of dismissed. And then got a call from Seth saying, you're not going to believe this, but it's coming back. Any chance you can get out of the Yes Dear thing? And Yes Dear was 20th as well as Family Guy. So it was an easy thing. And so, yeah, so he asked me to come and run it with him and David. Was it 2003, whenever?
Yeah, you're right. I think the first time it was 2004 and it aired in 2005. But now, so it sounds like you had a different experience that time coming back, because whereas the first time when you talk about, oh, Jesus, a cartoon, my career is over.
Yeah.
But then to make the decision, I'm leaving this successful show, Yes Dear, but I do want to go back to this cartoon. Did you see the writing on the wall? Like, they're not going to bring this back to cancel it again.
I didn't know how long it was going to last, but I did know that I really enjoyed working on it. And I enjoyed working on Yes Dear as well, but I had done, after Family Guy, I had worked on Titus for 2 years and then Yes Dear for 2 years. So I'd been in live action for 4 years at that point, and the thought of getting back to animation was nice. And I love it live action too, but it was sort of like, I'd been there for a bit. I wouldn't mind going back. And I really, you know, got along with all the writers. It was so much fun to work on in the first 3 years we were doing it. I was excited about going back. Yeah.
Was this your first time show running?
It was. Yeah. I had been a high level producer for a few years, but I had not run a show. So, and to be honest, like David and I were co-running it with Seth, but Seth was a showrunner. We were just number twos, essentially. I mean, Seth was in charge. Seth had the final say in everything.
Right.
Yeah. It's not like it is now David with Alec and Rich, who really have the final say in so much. Like it wasn't the same. Seth was all over it, which was a good thing. And David and I were sort of tasked with just keeping things moving forward and presenting Seth with options. And so Seth was the showrunner. We were sort of supportive number twos, really.
That's great.
We used to refer to you as the people's EP when you were when you were in that position, because there was a definite feeling like David was the Empire and you were the Rebellion. you were Luke Skywalker, and that's not, David's been on here many times and I've complimented him endlessly on the job that both of you guys did there. But there was a definite difference where I feel like David had more of that old school energy of like, do this, do that. And you were a much more like, you were sort of there on the ground level with a lot of the people. You were so nice to everyone down from, interns, like all the way up the chain. And is that something that, is that just your show running style? Is that like sort of a New England trait that you've brought with you, where you're just kind of like kind and accepting to everyone? Do you still feel that way running your show now? Like you're talking to everyone from the bottom to the top all the time?
I think, I don't know if it's a New England trait. I think it's the son of an alcoholic trait.
People pleasing.
which actually might be a New England trait.
Sure, that's part of it.
I mean, I was a middle child growing up, and I was definitely the one that I was going to hold this family together. Everything's going to be fine. Everything's good.
Yep.
Yes. I know dad seems a little bit absent, but he's doing the best he can.
Let's
give him a chance.
Taking care of everyone. That's
Seth showing up in the room at 4 p.m. And we've written all day and he throws it all out.
I think there's a lot of that in how I deal with things. And that's how I run Resident Alien as well. David and I definitely had two completely different styles in a lot of ways. And I think, and David and I have had this conversation too. I think we didn't want to work together, but I feel like we needed to work together.
Right.
Like two estranged brothers or like two kennel dogs thrown into a cage together and just trying to figure it out.
You can't argue with the results. I mean, I say this all the time, but from 2004 to 2009, 10 or whatever, I always look back at those seasons and I'm like, God, those shows turned out really funny. And I think it was the greatest period of the show's success. And certainly in terms of, being nominated for things, whatever that means, like that happened a lot more during that era. So was
a lot of people say the second I stepped through the writer's room door, it was the end.
You're not giving yourself enough credit.
The beginning of a new era.
It's so funny when Goldie finally, we had heard about Goldie for so long.
Yes.
From Alec. Like Alec would, I'm sure you've heard this, just trumpet about you for years. Like someone would pitch something, Goldie, let me tell you something Goldie said. And it was like, and it would be something funnier than what someone else just pitched. And then like this mythical Goldie character. And then we heard that Goldie's going to be coming on and stuff like that. Like this fucker.
Yeah, that primes everyone to like you.
He's never going to live up to this hype. And I will say, I absolutely
thank
did.
You.
Yay.
In every way, weirdly, was every bit as funny as Alec had said.
Very kind. Not true. But fine.
I love it.
And we've been through the Kaiser Soze story.
Listen, look at the son of the alcoholic trying to just reel me in, keep me involved.
He's going to keep this podcast together, God damn it.
Look, we can do this.
But those years on Family Guy, and back then we did work late, and a lot of that was because of Seth's, Seth was quite demanding in a great way about comedy, you know, things that made all of us laugh, but didn't make him laugh. He wouldn't put it in. Like you had to hit the right target. So how did you learn how to hit Seth's target over the years, or was it ever, to me, it seems like it kind of moves around a lot, but I don't know if you figured out like, okay, here are some things we can do to hit this target.
I think so. I mean, I think that's, look, the skill set of working on a show is nothing if it's not trying to capture the voice of the showrunner and whoever's, you know, got the main voice there. And on Family Guy, that's Seth. The entire job is to try to find Seth's voice and write that way. You can write a great Family Guy script, but if it's not the way Seth would write it, it's going to get thrown out and redone.
Yep.
And that's the way it should be. That's why these shows are specific and have a voice. So it is a skill set, to be honest, that I think we probably have more of than the new writers coming up, because we wrote spec scripts. You know, the samples that we wrote, you know, in the 80s, 90s, like in 2000s, you know, you write a Roseanne spec, you write a Friends spec, you write a Frasier spec, you study the show, you learn, you know, these comedies, you literally get a script and you count the number of jokes per page. How long are the speeches?
Right.
You know, how many acts do they have?
Yep.
What type of humor do they have? If you're writing a Friends spec and you have a lot of like political contemporary humor in it, it's not going to feel like the show because they don't do that.
Right.
You know, if you write a Seinfeld spec and there's two scenes in the whole show, it's not going to feel like a Seinfeld. So that was a skill set that we had to hone.
In the defense of people today, though, there was a monoculture and there were widely watched shows that would have been capable of being known by everyone. And I think if you show up now and you go, I'm going to write, you know,
what do you write?
I can't even think of it. I guess Abbott Elementary. I mean, I don't know exactly what you would write. And like, by the time you write most things, they would have been canceled. No one would have known them. So I do empathize with the plight of people trying to break in. Like, it's not entirely on like that just got discarded cavalierly.
Yeah.
That's true. That is
so
true.
We did. Yeah. So it is the job was trying to figure out Seth's voice. And I think as you guys certainly have, I think we did a pretty good job, but you know, for Seth's human too. You know, Seth's voice changed a little bit and Seth was, you know, was there and was so overworked at that period of time. So he was not only overseeing the writing, he was really doing so much of the animation work and editing and all this stuff and doing all those voices
Something I always found interesting was when people would describe it as, you know, frat boy humor.
Right.
And then you go in that room and you go, there's not a person in here who would be in a fraternity or, you know, be accepted. And it's so funny
was.
How
I was.
you would be. Not now, though, I'm saying. But that like the writers seemed sort of different from the audience in a way that I always found kind of fascinating.
I think it was more, in our defense, it was more 14-year-old humor than frat boy humor.
Right.
I think
yeah, frat boy gives us too much credit.
young boy humor. Young boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Chris, I like to give you shit occasionally because you are almost, you are incredibly humble about the things that you have done, about jokes you have written, episodes you've written. And so I remember, and you probably know what I'm going to say, every time I hear the song, I think it's by REO Speedwagon, the song, heard it from a friend who, heard it from a friend who, that you pitched a joke using those lyrics in a Family Guy episode that always stuck with me. It's like a joke that still makes me laugh. It was sort of like about how a rumor spread around around town. So whenever I'm anywhere and that song plays, which is a lot in New England, I like to text you and give you shit listening to this song. I remember you up on the table, whipping everyone up and dancing.
Wow. This is my joke.
No, because he didn't do that. That's my point. Like, he's so humble about this stuff that just the idea that Chris would stand up table and then take all the applause.
Everyone.
Whatever happens. And is that part of the way you grew up as well? Middle child, you know, all that stuff. I feel like you are humble almost to a fault.
where like you don't allow yourself to enjoy the credit of things that you've done?
It's a great question. I have thought about that a lot. I grew up not liking attention. I was always tall as well. Like I was like in ninth grade, I think I was 6'1" or something.
Yeah.
Okay, so wow. I had a slouch. It was all, you know, I didn't want to stand out. I remember in my, having a, in junior year, like applying, I think I was applying to Middlebury or something like that. And one of my English teachers had gone to Middlebury. So he was doing the interview, you know, to get into the school. And he was trying to, you know, one of the big things for all schools is like, what are your leadership capabilities? Something like that. And so he was talking to me about being a leader and about being, instead of being a follower. And I was trying to convince him that being a follower was better because if there's no followers, then there's no leaders. I mean, you got to have someone. So I didn't get into Middlebury, by the way, just, you know, trying to convince him that, no, I'm more of a follower. And he kept trying to help me not kill myself. He's like, no, but I've seen leadership abilities from you. I really think you have it. And you're like, nope, I'm a follower. You have a good leader. The leader's going to want me to follow them because I'm going to make them a better leader, but I'm the one behind the thing. But really, you could be a leader. No, I don't think so. Okay, I tried. You didn't get in now.
That's so
I don't know what it is. I mean, I am different now. I mean, that changed, I think. But I did. I never came from a place of standing on a desk, look at me. Right. I'm more comfortable with attention now than I was, but I did not like it when I was younger.
And we'll talk about Resident Alien here in a minute. But I wanted to hit one more story, which is something that I always think of when I think of you, and it really makes me laugh. And I want you to take it over if you remember it. So you were once walking around, I believe, Larchmont Village. Yo, you know exactly what I'm going to say. So take this story over here from what you can remember. I'll fill in the details.
Okay. This is awful. So I'm decent at remembering people's names, but sometimes there's just some people I just can't remember their name. And I don't know why. I just have a block. I don't know why. So Alec was friends with this dude. Great guy. Ted Mulcairn.
Yes.
And I could never remember his wife's name ever. And it drove me crazy. And I would see him. I live near Larchmont. They live near Larchmont. So I go to Larchmont and I see Ted and his wife. And I'd say, hey, and I couldn't then say Ted's name because then I didn't know the wife. So I'm like, hey guys. So now I'm like, now Ted thinks I don't even know his name. Right. And I know Ted's name. I'm rock solid with Ted's name. Could never remember the wife's name. I go into work, ask Alec, well, what is Ted's wife? He'd tell me. I'm like, oh yeah, next time. Next time, hey, well, how are you guys doing? Kids, you know, and it would drive me crazy, and I hated it. I hated the feeling of not knowing.
Yeah.
So one day I'm going through Larchmont. I have my earphones in. You know, I'm listening to music, jamming away, and I go up to the mailbox place. I go to open the door, and I look in, and they're in there. I'm like, motherfucker. I'm like, and I back away, and I'm like, what the fuck do I do? I'm like, I'm not doing this again. I'm not doing it. On my phone, I text Alec. What's Ted's wife's name? ASAP. Need it right away.
Yeah.
I see him. I need it. So I'm waiting. I'm looking inside. I said, come on, Alec. Come through for me here. I'm looking inside, and they're like buying some cards or something. And then they finish. They're heading to the door. I'm like, God damn it. They're coming. Alec, come on. Here they come. They're reaching for the door, and I hear, bididip. You know, I got a text. I'm like, I glance down, and they're coming through the door, and I glance down, and it says Shaba. And I'm like, here they come. And I knew it was a weird name, and they come out, and I'm like, Ted, Shaba, how you doing? No. What's going on? Shaba, how are you redoing the kitchen? And now I'm like, I'm all in now. I'm doubling down because, like, this is the first time in, like, a year I've seen them, and I know the name. Shaba, you doing a new kitchen? And she's looking at me weird, and I'm just doing it. And then I hear, bididip. And I said, new kitchen. I sort of glance down, and it's fucking Alec picks back, sorry, damn autocorrect. I meant Shauna. I'm like, God damn it. So now I have to triple down with Shauna. And I go back to them, and I'm talking now, and I like never pronounced the W so hard in someone's name. So Shauna. So the kitchen, are you doing marble tops or granite, Shauna? It was absolute disaster.
Oh,
and then So then I tell Alec the story, and it's like, fuck, and literally have not seen her since. Like, now I would know the name. Finally, I would know the name.
Right.
Haven't seen her since.
Oh, that always, yeah. And that just became shorthand for us for a while, just saying Shabba. Yeah.
Shabba. Yeah. I was so, they come out, Ted, Shabba.
Just a great moment in name fuck up history. That was so funny. Thank you for retelling that tale from your perspective. It always tickles me. Well, something else that tickles me, and now America, is Resident Alien. This is the show that you created and you run and you shoot it up in Canada, and you guys are 3 seasons in. It's a great show. It's such a fun tone. Like the comedic tone of that show is, it reminds me of, and I'm sure you've heard a lot of these comparisons before, shows like you know, sort of like a Northern Exposure, or you know, where the tone is just, it's like everybody's like 6 inches off the ground. It's not quite reality, but it's so fucking pleasant and funny. So tell me a little bit about how the show, you know, your process in creating it, how pitching it went, and how getting it onto the air went.
Yeah, it was in a period, this is probably in around 2013. I was doing a lot of flying because my daughter was in Connecticut and I still had a deal in LA. So I was basically for a couple of years going back and forth every week. And so I was flying a lot and watching a lot on the plane. And I was watching, all I was watching was these cable dramas, you know, The Wire, Breaking Bad, Friday Night Lights. And I'd go through all of them and I really loved them. And creatively, I started thinking I wanted to do that. At the time, I was part-time on Family Guy still trying to do pilots.
Yep.
But I wanted to shift over and maybe do an hour-long, more dramatic pilot. I had to write a spec because you can't, you know, you end up getting pigeonholed in this industry for good or bad. So I ended up writing a dramatic spec pilot, and with Amblin sort of went out with that, and it took me like 2 years to write that. Went out with that and didn't sell it, but it did open some doors in like this new world of like drama writing. And so Amblin started sending me projects, IP that they had, and nothing really got my interest until they sent me this graphic novel for this thing called Resident Alien. It was a comic book basically about this alien who lands on Earth and is observing humanity. And I liked it. And I was like, oh, I like aliens and I like Earth. So why don't I do this?
Yeah.
So that was October 2015.
Okay.
I spent probably 10 months coming up with what it was going to be, adapting it. I had to come up with new characters and a new arc for the alien, sort of figuring out the show.
Oh, wow.
And then pitched it in August of 2016 and sold it to USA, which then after selling it, they sort of shifted it over to Sci-Fi. USA, Sci-Fi, Bravo are the cable arm of NBC. So, so we shifted over to Sci-Fi, and then I started writing the script, and that took forever. I probably did 25 drafts over a year and a half.
Whoa.
And then shot the pilot. Ended up in January, I think, of January, February of 2018. So now I'd already been on it for 2.5 years. They chose to shoot the pilot. So then we shot the pilot in October 2018.
Whoa.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How did Alan Tudyk enter the equation? Because he's awesome. I mean, like he's the, brilliant. You know, this is his Tony Soprano turn. Like he's absolutely carries the show in a great way. So how, when you were casting, how did that all shake out?
Well, it's a good question. Like I thought I knew what this character was and I'd written the script. And there's, when you're casting, there's either casting someone or there's an offer only pool of writers.
Right.
The offer onlys are the more successful, typically writers, actors, are the more successful actors that won't come in and audition.
Right.
So I did feel like for this role, he's an alien, but he's sort of half human. Like I had to see what they were going to do.
Right.
Yeah.
So that pile of actors that were offer only, I just put aside. I said, I'll just ignore them and we'll just cast it. And then ended up seeing 112 actors.
Wow.
From all over, from US, England, Ireland, you know, and they were some great, great actors, but there was no one really popped. It was sort of, they were all, not all of them, but there was like, even the great ones were like, yeah, it's fine. You know?
Right. Right.
And then Alan, I think, was the 113th we had seen. We were getting no track. We weren't finding what we wanted with the casting process. And so David Dopkin was the director of the pilot, and he had done Wedding Crashers and The Judge and some other things. It was great. He said, how about this? He said, why don't we pick six actors in the offer only group, send them the script, have them read the script, and then ask if they'll audition for it.
Right.
Which I thought was very smart. So we sent the script out to these six actors. Alan was one of them. And we asked all these actors if they were willing to come in and audition. And all six of them agreed after reading the script to come in and audition for it.
Wow.
And so we went through that process with Alan. We met him over Zoom. We were already up in Vancouver because we were shooting it in like 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And had cast everyone else. David and I got together with him on a Thursday night over Zoom to talk about the character for 20 minutes as a discussion. And then the next day he would come in and audition for it. So we talked to him. And even that Thursday night, when we talked to him, we hung up and looked at each other and said, this might be the guy.
Wow.
And then when he auditioned on Friday, again, over Zoom, he went into the casting room. We were on video watching, and it just was fantastic. Like, I didn't know what the character was until he did it. He's fantastic.
Awesome. Oh, there it is.
That's awesome.
Like, he has something special.
Yeah, he has something special anyway. He's so incredible. He went to Juilliard. Like, he's so well-trained.
Yes.
But he's also, you know, he's just a different look. He looks, you know, he can make himself look a little like an alien.
Totally.
But there's still humanity in there.
Yes.
I don't know how he does it. Like, on set, he's like a normal person. And then he sort of gets ready for his thing, and then he comes out and he's just someone else.
It's his eyes. You're right. I think because you're doing stuff with your eyes. And I've noticed that about him on the show. There's something about his eyes where it does seem like there's something else going on behind those eyes. You know,
it's
like
unbelievable.
He's fantastic. So great job.
Incredible.
Great
so that
job.
Was incredibly lucky. And the rest of the cast is incredible. We got lucky with them as well. And
yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, it's been a long, you know, we've now done 3 seasons, 34 episodes, but it's taken us 6 years to do it, you know, from the point when we started the pilot, let alone, I mean, this is my 9th year working on the show.
Oh my God.
But as far as just shooting the pilot, it's taken 6 years to do three seasons. And part of that was COVID delayed it. And part of it was the strike delayed it. But some of it also just the nature of TV these days, it all just drags out.
Yeah.
Right.
And we were talking about this before we started. If anybody who hasn't seen the show, but is a fan of sci-fi, the network, there are some staples that are cast throughout the show that if, you know, like I always, it's almost like Easter eggs, you know, it's like, the woman who plays Sarah Connor in the Terminator.
Yeah, Linda Hamilton.
Linda Hamilton.
She's great.
Nathan Fillion is the Octo 42.
Yes. Terry O'Quinn is on it.
Terry O'Quinn, yes. John Locke. And Alan Tudyk,
Stepfather.
Of course.
Yeah.
Enver Yokaj, who was in Agent Carter, I think.
Sort of genre. I saw that. Yes.
Oh, what
yes.
Great name. That sounds like a Kilbourne second guest. Is Enver Yokaj. We got him. It's awesome, and it's still a going concern. There's nothing harder in our business than getting a show on the air. And then the next hardest thing is keeping it on the air for more than, you know, six episodes or a season. And the fact that it's still going, I think, is a credit to, you know, all the performers and certainly to you who, you know, put this thing together and it just constructed it in the right way. And so now a very fun thing about this show, we were talking about this before we started too, is that it recently appeared on Netflix. And, you know, I didn't know it was coming there. And then one day it was there. And not only was it there, it was the number two downloaded thing on Netflix for whatever, you know, for a few days when I kept going back to it. So that must feel pretty cool because you're getting a much bigger audience.
Yeah, it's a great feeling. You know, every year we're waiting for a new season and we're always on the bubble. Are we going to get picked up or not? Because it's just really hard these days to drag an audience to cable. You know, sci-fi is genre. It's hard to get people there. I feel like every year the show is on the air is another year of fewer people watching actual television and not streaming.
Right.
And then it's also on Peacock, which is great, but has the lowest subscriber numbers. So it's just hard to build a big audience. So having it go on Netflix changes kind of everything in a
way,
as far as awareness goes. And since it came out February 13th and has been in the top 10 for a few weeks now.
That's incredible. Amazing. And we talked about this too, this noise.
Back Up the Money Truck on Netflix.
No, I don't think it works that way.
Well, no, because the strike. So we definitely, you know, you're going to be making billions now.
I actually think it was, I don't know. I'm not sure they didn't maybe just give it to Netflix to try to get promotional awareness. But it's great. It's great for the show. And it definitely, I think it's not, and it's now starting to, just this past week, I think, go into Europe as well. So I think it's,
Oh, that's great.
I think it's the number one Netflix show in Italy right now.
Oh, awesome. Yes. Woo. Yeah. Well, you're talking about the number 96 podcast in Yemen. So, you know,
I heard that.
We all have
up from 98.
Yeah. International flavor here. No, but it's awesome. And, you know, we wish you obviously continued success with that show because it's great. You know, it's funny. We've talked on the show a little bit and we obviously you can't quite get into it as much as you'd want, but there is this sort of natural instinct when writers, you know, or people you've worked with go on and have their own success. There's a part of you that's like, oh, fuck that.
But 100%.
But
no matter who
it is. I can say with you that there's no trace of that. Like it really does, I think, make all of us collectively like very happy to see this show doing well, still on the air.
Maybe Goldie's not being pretty
maybe,
quiet
maybe,
right
maybe
now.
Not Tom. Yeah, Goldie hasn't said anything, but
happiness is elusive.
Yeah, maybe Goldie and Tom don't quite call him the cat. Haven't caught it.
No, I enjoy it. And yeah,
I appreciate that. I mean, you know, I miss the Family Guy days and obviously for both of you and have learned an awful lot from both of you guys.
Well, you know, if that thing ever gets shit canned, you're always welcome back as a consultant.
Yep. This is being recorded.
A lot of warning on that. Maybe 2-3 seasons out. No, but Chris, it's awesome. We love that the show's doing so well, and we love you. We're so glad you finally agreed to be on the podcast. Yes. And I think it was great talking to you. Yes. So
I don't think anyone turned their volume up to listen to my stories, but
you had great stories.
I'm happy. I'm thrilled to be here.
It would be great if Damien actually cranked it in his car.
Reverse.
Yeah. he might care.
He turned it off after Philippines.
Tall, good-looking white guys like to stick together. No, but Chris, seriously, thank you so much for being here today. And,
thank you.
Best of luck with
again, a huge fan of your podcast. Absolutely. Aww.
Thank you. That's we so love sweet. Hearing that. Oh God, Sheridan is such a nice guy. I love it.
Yes,
I'm I so love glad. When guys are nice, but it quietly kills them. he's nice, and I think it eats away at him how nice he always is. But he is absolutely the nicest guy and one of the greatest writers.
Very
funny.
Yep.
Really great talking to him, and so happy for his success. All right, and now it's time for a portion of the show we like to call Top 5.
Top 5.
Oh, we're beautiful. All right, Goldie, this was your topic. What are we top fiving about?
Yeah, so I don't remember my exact wording when I said it, but the spirit is the top 5 shows or performances you've ever attended live and in person. Top 5 things you've seen
live
with your own two eyes in the room.
Love it.
And here are mine. Number 5, it was on Cape Cod in the Chatham Playhouse, the Ohio State Players performing A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Wow.
I was maybe 12, and it was like the first real funny play I had ever seen. I really laughed.
I was in that. I was a freshman in high school. I played Hysterium.
I love that musical, but I have not seen it since I was 12 or whatever. I might hate it now.
Yeah, probably.
Something awesome. Familiar. Something for you.
Yeah. Something for everyone. A comedy tonight.
Number 4 was the Beastie Boys at Roseland in New York. Yes. And I crowd surfed.
What?
Oh,
sick.
Wow.
What year was that? Was that a...
It must have been either 96 or 97. It was the Check Your Head tour.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, great show. Yeah. Number 3 was in Los Angeles, the Producers with Martin Short and Jason Alexander.
Oh,
wow.
That's
hilarious.
Great. What a cast.
Number 2 was the emotional sneak attack of the musical Wicked.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Just got me. And number 1 was post 9/11 Bruce Springsteen at Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
Oh. Wow. Now, yeah. Wait, JC, is it me or is it yours next week? Oh, shit.
It's me.
So I go now?
Yes, you go now.
Oh, thank Christ. I don't have it. Okay.
I'm done and I can start chewing gum.
Oh, there he goes. What kind of gum is it?
Oh, Trident Vibes, baby.
All vibes. All vibes in this house. All right. Number five for me is something I was actually lucky enough to be a part of. And it was Gary Jannetty's Les Mis flash mob.
Oh, yeah.
That's August of 2011, I believe. And boy, was that fun.
That's cool.
I got a good pit stain working in my armpit that night.
It was so funny. That was, I was going to bring that up. That's all everyone remembers.
That's all I remember. That's all anyone remembers.
Yeah, that incredible romantic gesture. Yeah, didn't Alec have a lot of sweat on his arm?
A ton. I was nervous and it was hot. Okay. Number four. I've taken flack for this on here and I'm prepared to do it again. I saw Cats in London in 1982 with my dad when it had just opened. We were right up front. We were part of a moving stage that would move around. And the cats were, I loved the music. The girl cats were so hot and they were like dancing in my face, like winking at me. It was just the greatest. Number three for me is a similar theme. Actual Les Mis, November 87 in Boston. It was the Broadway preview. And boy, did that blow me away. The Act One closer, One Day More, I think is one of the best songs in musical history. I was shivers, chills the whole show.
I don't know what it is, but I have an idea for a show called Miz. It's a one-man show where I do play Miz. I don't know what it is.
The title's there. The title is set in stone.
I guess it's just me. It could be just me complaining.
Yeah, that would be great. You have nothing to do with the musical. That would be awesome. Number two for me, Super Bowl 49, one I did not leave at halftime. The Pats Seahawks. It was the Malcolm Butler interception. I got there 2 hours early, never left my seat, not to piss, not to get a beer. Nothing. I was glued into the seat and it was just an electrifying game. So that was number two.
Awesome.
And number one, the Allman Brothers Band on March 2nd, 1992 at Springfield Symphony Hall, which is like a 1500 seat arena. I went there with my buddy, Tom Hudner, who's a friend of the podcast. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We got so stoned in his mom's Volvo. And then we went in and it was one of those nights where the music, it just had feeling and 50% of the crowd were Hell's Angels and it was just unbelievable.
That's so cool.
Goldie, great topic. I really enjoyed remembering all of this stuff. So
yes,
thank you for that. And JC, what do we have next week?
Well, I haven't gone yet.
Oh, sorry. JC, go ahead.
Well, okay. So I originally only had musical performances, but then when we discussed earlier, I added one. So my number five, which could be at any number, is witnessing the Jeremy Lin breakout game.
For
the Knicks.
Linsanity.
Yes, that was a really big deal. I cried. He spoke to the crowd. It was very special.
Yeah.
My number four is number four.
We have to go to work in 3 minutes.
I know. Number four is Muse at Webster Hall, 2005. Amazing band. You guys aren't big fans of theirs. Number three is Radiohead at MSG in 2001.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that's Kid A. Kid A, yes, Radiohead. Yeah. Yes. Awesome.
Number two, Paul McCartney at the Fleet Center in 2000.
Awesome.
I screamed. I didn't know it was going to be that crazy.
It's great. I'm jealous.
Yeah. And number one, in 1992, it was Henry Rollins, Cypress Hill, and Beastie Boys. It was an incredible show. Still one of my favorites of all time.
Where was that?
I can't. It was in the Bay Area, but I cannot. I can see it, but it was in San Francisco, but I can't remember exactly where. I just remember being there.
God, I used to love Cypress Hill.
Oh my God, so good.
Cypress Hill is, I've said this before, in my mind, every Yankee fan sounds like the Cypress Hill lead singer.
Hey, what you want?
That's hilarious.
Oh, God. Oh, that was okay. Very fun. So what are we doing next week, JC?
Okay, next week, I'm going to try this one. Top five superstitions.
Oh, awesome.
I don't know.
Very superstitious. All right. Well, I totally want to ditch High Note today.
Well, I mean, you guys have to get back to work.
Fuck High Notes.
Can we? Oh.
Oh, don't say that.
Just today. Yeah, don't just say today. That. Lightly fuck them.
is everybody okay with that, Goldie?
Well, don't put me on the spot. I just want to help my friend out.
No, I'm the one who's saying I don't think we should do High Note today. We have to get back to work.
Yeah, you could just say you're the boss. You have to get back to work.
Yeah, my boss is making me get back to work.
That's true.
All right.
Always do a podcast with your boss. Yeah. That's my career advice. And tie a friendship in there too. Really also, safe, cool thing to do.
Listeners, if you were listening to the show and did not know which one of us was the boss, would you guess me? I don't know.
Well, that's what makes it so infuriating.
I know. Oh, God. There's your High Note. All right. Well, I want to thank Chris Sheridan, who was awesome.
Oh,
I want to thank you two, who were awesome. And thank you all for listening. We will talk to you again next week.
Oh, no.
That was fun.
And it stops right now.
Ted Shaba, how you doing?
Heard it from a friend who
Always do a podcast with your boss.